Welcome to Red Eyes Creations Radio. Thank you very much for tuning in. My name is Henrik Palmgren. This is Internet Talk Radio, coming to you from the west coast of Sweden. Our website is redeyescreations.com. Go there, check it out for our news, radio archives, live programs, short films, links, resources, and of course our member section filled with material for you. And today we're going to talk about a very important story, hidden from history, the Canadian Holocaust, the genocide of Aboriginal peoples in Canada. We have Kevin Annett with us to talk about this and his film Unrepentant. And this is available right now on video, on Google Video. We have had it linked up on Red Eye, so you might have seen it. The documentary film reveals Canada's darkest secret, the deliberate extermination of Indigenous or Native American peoples, and the theft of their land under the guise of religion. And Kevin Annett is a former minister who blew the whistle on his own church, and after he learned of thousands of murders in its Indian residential schools. The website that you need to visit is hiddenfromhistory.org. That's hiddenfromhistory.org. For much more information, the latest developments for the film, of course, and I'm also going to ask a little bit more about the book Hidden from History later in the program about that. So again, this is a very important story that has its roots within the organized church and the government. It's going to be really enlightening talking with Kevin Moore today. So with that, welcome to the program, and thank you very much for coming on, Kevin.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You know, where do we begin in a way? This is a big story, but I think the logical thing here is to start from the top. And if you can, for the audience that might not be familiar with the story, tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and kind of the story that you have been kind of uncovering for over, I guess, 10 or 15 years now, Kevin.
Yeah. Well, the story really began for me in 1992. I had been ordained as a minister in the United Church of Canada for about 2 years, and that's the largest Protestant church in Canada. It was actually set up by the government back in 1925, but I was ordained as a minister there in 1990, and 2 years later, I went to the west coast of Canada on Vancouver Island to a small community called Port Alberni. And traditionally, that was the spot where a lot of the missionary activity happened among the west coast Native nations. And I didn't know that at the time. Like a lot of white Canadians, I was very ignorant of our own history, knew nothing really about the residential schools and what had gone on in them. So I went and I was working as a minister there. In the first few months, I opened a food bank and began to invite local Native people into the church. And that's when I first began to hear these stories of children dying in the local residential school that had been run by my church at the time, the United Church, for over 50 years. I began to invite these people into the church and allow them to speak from the pulpit, and we began to hear more of these stories. But as I learned more, I found that the church at the time was in no way willing to look at any of these things. This is before any of the lawsuits had begun. And so I was told in no uncertain terms to be quiet and not to look into this stuff. At the time, I was married and had two small daughters. And, you know, there was a lot of pressure being brought to bear that simply not to look at these things. But after about 3 years, the boot came down, so to speak. And after I had written a letter, I discovered that the church, there'd been a whole history of churches that had basically stolen Native land initially to set up their missions, then selling off that Native land to various logging companies. And in this case, the United Church had a close relationship with a company called McMillan Bloedel that eventually was bought up by the biggest logging company in the world, a U.S. company called Weyerhaeuser. Mm-hmm. And they were profiting off stolen Native land thanks to the church, who was handing over this land to them. And that was a real concern to me, because according to our church policy, you weren't allowed to do that. You were supposed to return the land to the Native people and not sell it off to your white corporate friends, you know. So I wrote a letter about that, just citing our church policy, and within 4 weeks I was just summarily removed from my pulpit. No review, no questions, no cause at all. And eventually I was thrown out of the church altogether at the cost of about $250,000. So, I mean, all of that came down on me in the early to mid-1990s. And as a result, my family fell apart. My wife left me and filed for divorce. And the church actually helped her in her lawsuit against me in divorce court. She got custody of her two daughters.
Hmm.
So, I mean, all of this was just, it was a terrible thing happening to me. But as that happened more and
You know, we know that genocide, so to speak, has been going on for a long time. We can talk about the root of that a little bit later, but in regards to the, you know, murders that you have uncovered, if you would to kind of give us a little bit of time frame of, on where we are here, so to speak, on the map. Is this something that just happened in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, or does this, you know, continue to this day? Do you know, Kevin?
Well, it does. The high death rate does continue to the day, and this day, and it's almost like the aim has always been the same: to get native people off the land, to get the resources, to keep them imprisoned in their own country, if you like, by putting them in a lower class of citizenship than anybody else through a thing called the Indian Act. So that's always been the aim, but the methods have changed over the years. The residential schools were set up in the 1880s, and they went through, they lasted over a century. The last one didn't close till 1996. Basically, what it was is in the West, up until the late 1800s, something like 90% of the native population had been wiped out, mostly through smallpox. And the remnant populations saw their children carted off into these schools, where half of them never came back. We found the death rate in the residential schools consistently for over 50 years. The death rate was around 50%. So, you know, half of these children died off because of a practice even described by Indian agents and medical doctors from the government. There was a very famous report by a guy called Dr. Peter Bryce,
yes,
who studied the health conditions in the Western residential schools. He found that children who were sick with tuberculosis were being deliberately housed with the healthy, and then nobody was ever treated. And then, you know, they'd be dying en masse. We figured that over a century, over 50,000 children died that way. And the government's even acknowledged this last year. They acknowledged the 50% death rate figure, and that's even being reported in some of the major newspapers now in Canada. But it's kind of like they say, oh, yeah, well, this thing happened, but in effect, nobody's to be held accountable for it. You know, the churches who are primarily the ones responsible for that, they've never been held accountable, and no one has even ever gone to trial in Canada for the death of a child in a residential school. So it's an incredible denial and cover-up happening around this, even though they've acknowledged, you know, that these were very high death rates.
But the system, so to speak, I'm not familiar with it. Residential schools, define that for the audience that are not familiar with that.
Well, another term is just Indian boarding schools. It was a law brought in 1920 where every native child who was older than seven had to go into one of these schools, and it was basically far away from where they lived quite often. They lived there full-time. You know, officially they were allowed to go home in the summer, but a lot of the kids we just kept year-long. So I've talked to a lot of survivors of these places who tell me that they were kept there for 10 years or more, and they never saw their parents, they never saw their relatives. And these were really what they were internment camps. Children received very little education. The formal education stopped after a couple of years. They were basically given the chance to learn to read and write, but no higher education. They were put to work as cheap labor. The girls as domestic servants, the boys working as field hands. And it was to create like a permanent underclass. And that's still the effect in an Aboriginal world today. You know, you asked earlier, how is it still going on? Well, I work in an area in Vancouver called the Downtown East Side. It's one of the poorest areas of Canada. It's over half the people who live there are Aboriginal, and they die at a rate 20 times the national average. You know, it's not uncommon to see people die in their 30s and 40s from diabetes, from suicide, from violence. All of this, if you look at the people who are suffering, all of them went through these residential schools. They were terrorized from a young age, brutalized. I mean, some of the things going on in there, they had electric shock torture chairs they set up. They had sterilization programs where and this has already been the subject of lawsuits, they had hospitals operated on the West Coast where they would sterilize thousands of Native children as soon as they reached puberty. It was in order to exterminate the population, to get Native people off the land and depopulate areas that the whites wanted, especially the areas that were very had a lot of resources.
Oh yeah,
the lumber and the minerals and the fisheries. Definitely, they were targeted for that, and so this was all part of kind of a bigger plan of really ethnic cleansing.
And this, you know, as we said there, this has been well pretty much, I guess, going on since day one, since the European came to, you know, over to the American continent, basically, and this has just continued. And now the connection here between, let's say, the residential school system over there in Canada then. What is there any kind of clear connection between that and what the United Church is doing? And also, if you can for us, explain a little bit about the United Church. Is that a Catholic Protestant branch? What is it?
No, it's the biggest Protestant church in Canada. These boarding schools were run by all the main churches. The Roman Catholics ran about two-thirds of them.
Mm-hmm.
And then the United Church ran the rest, along with the Anglican Church, the Church of England. And those three churches are responsible for most of the residential schools. The United Church played a big role because it was set up by the government as part of their plan to kind of assimilate the immigrant population. Like after World War One, a lot of people were coming from Europe over to Canada. And the establishment here was very concerned that they were going to get swamped by all these, you know, foreign populations. And they considered native people as in the same category as immigrants. They were like a foreign population that had to be controlled. And that was one of the purposes of the United Church, to go into these areas. And what they called mission work was actually identifying the indigenous, the traditional leaders, and wiping them out. Like often, what missionaries would do is literally with the Royal Canadian Mounted Police officers, they would go into the houses of the traditional chiefs and throw them out, evict them. Hmm. Then they would bring in Christian native chiefs, and they would replace the traditional chief.
Really?
And, yeah, I mean that happened all over the country, and the families targeted for sterilization were usually the traditional chiefs who didn't want to go along with the church and the government. They were literally wiped out. And so a lot of the chiefs today are not actually the original chiefs. They were brought in. They were kind of like the collaborating, like you get in any system of colonialism. You had a certain group of people collaborating. And they were the ones who were elevated to positions of authority. And they're the ones actually who are running a lot of the native groups in Canada today. So it's that whole legacy of colonialism that we're dealing with.
My God, it's an incredible story. And, you know, you mentioned before here the Indian Act of Canada. And as far as I understood it, while watching your film, of course, says that the Indians have a legal status of a child or even a mentally ill. Is that correct?
That's right. There's the Indian Act, if you look at the wording, right in the preamble, it says, and this was an act brought in 1874 and has never changed, really. It's still in effect. And it says, Indians are legal wards of the state in perpetuity, which means until the end of time. And a ward of the state is you can't handle your own affairs. The government acts, appoints a ward to act on your behalf, so you can't go to court. You're not considered a legal entity. You can't open a bank account, and none of that. So under the Indian Act, that's the status of Native people. And, you know, as such, they can treat Native people any way they like.
Yeah.
You know, a perfect example of that is recently the government's been, because of a lot of the work I've been doing, information is finally coming out, and so the government was forced to last year not only acknowledge the high death rate, but start issuing what they call compensation to, you know, financial compensation to survivors of these death camps, really.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Called residential schools, and they're only offering $10,000, if you can believe it. $10,000 to a survivor is all they get, and they have to prove they went to a school. Well, how many people can do that? Well, how do they have access to that paperwork? Most people have been disqualified because they can't prove they went to a school.
Mm-hmm.
Elsewhere, you know, when the churches are sued for sexual abuse, like in the United States, the survivors are getting $1-2 million compensation. But in Canada, a Native person is worth 1% of that, and they know they have to take it because there's no way legally they can say to the government, no, I'm not going to, because they're wards of the state.
Mm.
So they're really in a dilemma, and it's interesting that I believe that after World War II, the United Nations actually banned race-based legislation, which is why the apartheid regime in South Africa was condemned, because you can't bring in laws aimed at a particular group
right, to
the exclusion of others, because that's an element of genocide. Yet the Indian Act is still in effect. How is that allowed to happen when, you know, the United Nations supposedly spoke out, you know, banned that kind of legislation?
Yeah, there you go. It's a big hint there in a way. You know, as far as I see it, I see personally that this is something that expands and kind of permeates in through many countries, and that this is a system basically coming from the British. We can try tied back to the British Isles. And one of the things about the origins of this, if we talk about the Indian Act of Canada, of course, you mentioned something in the film called the Bago or Bago Commission. That is created by the Vatican back in, I think, 1845, the Gradual Civilization Act. Tell us about that, if you will.
Yes. Well, that's why definitely the British played a big role in this. I mean, my relatives are from Ireland, and I've seen the effect of the same policies happening in Ireland and the Scottish Highlands, where they, you know, were trying to basically wipe out the indigenous culture and language, and you know, so it certainly was not unique to Canada, but it goes, it's even older than the British Empire. It really originates in Christendom, in the whole in the Roman Catholic Church.
In Rome, yeah.
The Bagot Commission was actually, you know, the attitudes that are that were there were actually very old, and in fact, you can trace it right back to a thing called the Romanus Pontifex, which was a law brought in the 1450s by Pope Nicholas, and he basically said in that law, papal bull, Christian kings have the moral duty and the right to subdue all non-Christian. They call them Saracens. Pagans.
Mm.
And the reason they had the right to do that is because non-Christian people do not have the right to their own land and their own identity because they're not Christian. And that idea has, that law has never been revoked by the Vatican. You know, a series of laws, including the Inter-Qatar Bill of 1493, that divided the world between Spain and Portugal, the entire world. And all of those laws are still in the books in the Vatican, and the attitudes behind them are still in place, too. The attitude is, you know, I think the idea has been secularized now into a more kind of corporate capitalist model that anybody outside our system doesn't have the right to remain themselves. They have
right.
to be absorbed into our system or destroyed. And that was the attitude behind Christian genocide in the New World, and it's still the attitude, you know, behind imperialism today, that people don't have the right to hold on to themselves. They have to be part of our system, or they're a fair game, if you like. So, I mean, that's an old idea, and it permeated all the European empires.
Yeah.
Which is probably why, as you say, at the United Nations, it's so hard to raise this, because all of the countries are implicated. I mean, what country didn't have an empire where they, you know, did this to indigenous people?
Absolutely, and many of these countries now are under the same umbrella, if you will. You mentioned that the kind of the law or even the mentality spawns back to Rome. But the land, as I understand it now, we can talk about the Commonwealth or what have you. The land is owned by the crown, isn't that right? The land that has been, you know, seized or taken from the native populations.
That's right. The British acted this way all over the world. They went into an area based, again, they're basing it on these three laws brought in by the Vatican in the 15th century, the late 15th century. England adopted similar laws when they began to invade the New World. And basically, it said the British Crown automatically owns all the land. And then they hold it in trust for the native people, who then occupy the land at the behest of the Crown. So in other words, native people do not own their own land anymore. They're just occupying it and administering it on behalf of the Crown.
Hmm.
That's the legal status of native people in Canada, that they're just squatters on their own land, and suddenly the British Crown owns everything. You know, and so it's an amazing kind of theft operating under the guise of, you know, quote, civilization and Christianity.
Yeah, there you go. And of course, what you discovered, I guess, along the road here is that this, as you mentioned before, that this is something that also, we have the church behind this, we have the crown behind it, but also the arm, the extension of this, of course, is the corporate world, if you will, the many of the companies that are coming in, taking over the land, and they're probably utilizing the land for minerals, oils, other resources, right?
Very much. As a matter of fact, you know, I mentioned the native people I work with in Vancouver. Most of them are refugees from their own land, and a lot of them are from northern British Columbia and northern Canada, and they've been forced off their land because their own chiefs sign deals with different resource companies, evicts them from their land in order to, you know, flood the area to get hydroelectric power, to log off the land. And a lot of these people are then landless, and they come down and they're in extreme poverty and disease, and they're dying off in the cities. You know, like you get in any third world country, the same thing happens in Canada. These chiefs profit from these deals, you know, and the net effect is the land remains in the hands of, you know, a small number of people, and it's the same kind of thing that's been happening from the beginning.
Now, I mean, we can talk a little bit about some of the incidents, some of the things that you've uncovered along the way, along the road here in your film. Of course, you have many interviews with many people that have experienced this for themselves, many you know, eyewitnesses and so forth that have been coming out, and they talk about everything from torture to harassment to traumatization, and of course even murders by nuns, priests, and teachers. You know, there's many, you know, examples of this. For instance, back in, I think it was 1946, a girl called Maisie Shaw was killed by a guy called Alfred Caldwell, the principal of the Alberni Residential School. And I guess that these just as one example there, these are all in one way or another documented, isn't that right?
That's right. You know, the case of Maisie Shaw was the first one that came out. A woman called Harriet Nahoney witnessed this killing. And she came out shortly after I was fired. We're having like a protest down at the United Church office to try to get me reinstated. And Harriet saw it advertised in the paper, so she came down. And she described how when she was 10 years old, she saw this happen. She was hiding under the stairs in the United Church residential school in Port Alberni. And she heard Caldwell, who was the principal, arguing with one of the white matrons. And Maisie was a little 14-year-old girl, and she was crying there for her mother. It was Christmas Eve, and she wasn't allowed to go home. Caldwell turned and kicked her in the stomach, and she went tumbling down the stairs, these concrete stairs, and fell. And Harriet looked, and she saw that the little girl's eyes were open, but she wasn't breathing or moving. The next day, she disappeared, and the government later claimed, and the United Church claimed, that she died of pneumonia. But, you know, Harriet was an eyewitness. We went to the RCMP, you know, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, and they refused to investigate. They just outright refused. They said there's no evidence, and this is not a credible witness, they said.
So how far up the ladder do we need to go here? Are all the major, you know, governing entities of society in on this? That they know the plan here, you know?
Yeah, in Canada, that's the reality. The government and the church has set up the residential schools. It was a joint operation. The RCMP went in. Actually, it's crazy for the RCMP to investigate this because they're investigating themselves. The RCMP in the 1930s were deputized to go in and act as the arm of the residential schools. They would go into the villages and gather up all the children. They would often take kids as young as two or three, just clean out the village of all the children and house them in these terrible places. And then when the kids ran away, it was the RCMP who would hunt them down. We've got letters proving that, you know, RCMP reports about how they did this. So, you know, the system can't investigate itself and put itself on trial, which is why you're getting this big whitewash now.
Right.
And okay, take a few $1,000 and they'll go away. Imagine if it was white children who suffered like this. If half the white children in a school never came back, there'd be a huge criminal investigation. But the other day, the government announced that, yes, they're finally acknowledged that criminal acts occurred in the schools, but there will be no criminal investigation.
Really?
And that's astounding. That's like saying we know these crimes occurred, but we're not going to hold the people who we know did them, we're not going to hold them accountable.
And I mean, this to me, when I hear this suggests that a lot of people are aware of what's going on, because in many cases, if we talk about conspiracy, which this is, in many cases, you think that it's fairly kind of restricted, if you will, to a handful of people maybe that have this particular agenda and that manage to utilize the system in order to advance their own agenda. But this sounds like it's, you know, it must be hundreds of people involved in something like this, correct?
Well, even more. I mean, you know, it's in the thousands of people who are still alive who were involved in the residential schools. And it wasn't just schools. There were Indian hospitals connected to the schools where a lot of these sterilization and medical experiment programs went on. We've tried to access the records of the Indian hospitals, and they were officially sealed by the government in 1999. So you can't actually access this anymore. But I have been able to find through other people some evidence of these. There were the government was paying every doctor $300 in the 1950s if they sterilized a native woman. They'd often do it after the woman had given birth when she was still anesthetized. They would just tie her tubes and sterilize her without knowledge. There were laws in British Columbia and Alberta allowing that. And so, I mean, this is exactly what the Nazis did.
Yep.
And yet, they're, you know, these people, none of them has ever gone to trial for any of this.
Children being sterilized, subjected to medical experiments. You mentioned kind of Nazi-style medical experimentation going on. There's so much of this, and this is something that also is continuing, as far as I understand it. This is something that is happening. Is that right?
That's right. It's interesting because the World Health Organization acknowledged a couple of years ago that they were putting a sterilizing agent in polio vaccines that they were giving to people in the Philippines and in Africa. So, I mean, the sterilization programs continue. They're just done pharmaceutically now instead of intrusively like they'd before by tubal ligations. And one of the other means, we talked about this in the film, held under an X-ray machine for 10 or 15 minutes.
Yes, yes.
And he was sterile after that, as were his seven brothers.
Yeah.
And so, you know, this was definitely aimed as a way to wipe out the native population.
And
I should just mention that under the United Nations Convention on Genocide, which is a law and Canada ratified and has adopted, all five of their definitions of genocide did occur in residential schools,
mm-hmm.
including preventing births and causing deaths and creating the conditions where over the long run people are going to die off. All of those things occurred in residential schools, yet Canada's never been brought before the UN for these crimes.
And do you think that they ever will be?
Well, there's a move afoot. Like about 10 years ago, we held a tribunal in Vancouver where we did have UN officials who were present. And unfortunately, Canada prevented action on that. But recently, various indigenous groups in the Philippines and in Guatemala have been trying to get countries at the General Assembly to bring forward a motion to have Canada investigated. And there is some development happening there, which is one of the reasons we're actually this month, our film on Repentant is being shown in a number of places in Europe, including Italy and in Germany, and at the London Native Film Festival on October 21st.
Mm-hmm.
So our hope is that other people in Europe, once they learn this, will help pressure the countries to bring forward that kind of motion and bring pressure to bear on Canada, you know, like boycotting Canadian goods, boycotting the 2010 Olympics in British Columbia, that kind of thing.
Oh, yeah, the Vancouver, exactly, the upcoming Olympics, there have already been quite a holler around that in regards to how even, areas, of course, are being exploited, in regards to environment and so forth. But this is another issue, of course. Do you see that there is any way of reaching out more to the other countries of the world when the Olympics finally going to land over there, you know?
Yes, well, we're planning on doing that. I'm hoping to come to Europe in the spring, maybe in March, and give talks about that and show our film. We actually have the film translated into several languages now, other languages. So this is an important way to kind of you show the world that Canada's never going to hold itself accountable. The Canadian courts are doing their best to make sure this stuff never comes to trial. And one of the only ways we have left is that kind of, embarrassing Canada and hurting them economically. That's the way that traditionally, I mean, this is how these things first came out, because the churches were facing lawsuits.
Yes. There's other things here as well. You know, we talked about they have been using kind of different methodology, if you will, to exterminate people. They have used historically tuberculosis. We know the stories about the blankets handed out and so forth. There's a number of ways of their techniques, so to speak, that they're doing this. Even smallpox, something about that the children were allowed to play with each other, meaning that those who had smallpox could infect the non-infected ones. Isn't that right?
That's the main way. Yeah, the high death rate was often because of that practice. It was germ warfare. You would take healthy kids, lock them in a dorm with kids who were suffering from tuberculosis, and then never treat them. And you don't die right away from tuberculosis. You have to be kept in those conditions over several months and be given substandard food and lower the immune system so that the TB can finally kill you off. The fact that so many died from that shows that it was intentional because, if the moment they got TB, normally they'd be quarantined.
Mm.
Before penicillin, that's the way you dealt with tuberculosis. You just quarantine the person. We have pictures, and that we showed one in the film, of children who are healthy sitting alongside kids whose heads are wrapped because they have tuberculosis sores, open tubercular sores. They're sitting there. None of them are quarantined. So why do they have that practice towards natives, but everybody else in Canada who got TB were quarantined? That's an example historically of how they did it. But when you asked earlier, I didn't completely answer that about how it's continuing today.
Mm.
In Canada, if you're a native person, there's a war of terror against you. I mean, regularly, police beat native people to death in prison. They die of exposure on the streets. Like I say, they're forced off their own land. And there's a whole, program of kind of letting them silently die off. And that's really part of the same agenda that's been in place from the beginning.
Now, in regards to, I guess we could call it, the payoff within quotes here, the benefit of what these people would get if they do something like this. My mind is drawn back to, for instance, James Goodbrand, I think his name was. He sterilized women back in the 1950s. And in your film, one of the women were telling a story, her story, Sarah Modesty, that said that Dr. Goodbrand was paid about 300, Canadian dollars for every Indian woman that he sterilized. Do you think that something like this could still be going on? Like, for instance, police are you know, given money under the table if they arrest someone or even, you know, shoot someone? I don't know. What do you think,
well,
Kevin?
I've given you, I think that goes on, but I have a specific case of that. There's a Native woman, and I can't mention her name over the air yet because she hasn't brought her lawsuit out yet, but she's planning to sue the government and the churches because in 1987, she was told by the government that unless she had an abortion, she's a Native woman living in Vancouver, the social worker said she had to have an abortion and have her tubes tied or she wouldn't be able to see her other children who were in white foster homes. And so she went ahead and did that. So it seemed to be a policy of the social welfare agencies in Vancouver in 1987 to demand that, you know, if Native women would see their kids again or continue to receive social welfare benefits, that they would have to agree to sterilization.
Mm.
So it shows you it isn't in the past. This kind of stuff carries on. And on my website, hiddenfromhistory.org, there's actually a videotape of how a lot of Native women in the United States were sterilized older in the 1970s and 80s. And often through pharmaceutical methods, you know, through
inoculations and things like this.
Inoculations and those methods. Vaccinations.
Gotcha. And you know, there is a few other kind of interesting things here that were mentioned also in the film. Like for instance, it kind of briefly swept by, but I do want to get your comment on it and see if you have any kind of more information on it. A Catholic order called, I think you said the Manfreds or the Manfreds.
Monfreds,
okay, that were in charge of a specific, was it a specific school or region or what was it?
Well, the Monfreds, they were a religious order from Germany and Holland originally. And in the 1920s, they were in Canada. They set up a school called the Cooper Island Catholic Residential School. That's just on the west coast of Vancouver Island. It's just off the coast here, just a few miles from where I'm speaking, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And the Monfords ran these schools where they brought in German-speaking doctors in the 1930s. And we have eyewitnesses who describe these doctors came in, they could only speak German, they seemed very out of place, and they were giving Native kids shots in their chest that was killing them. They were doing some kind of experimentation on them. And then one of the boys ran away, the local police heard the story, and they came in to investigate, and in one night, all of the Monford brothers disappeared. They were just taken right out of the school, and they were replaced by the Oblates, which was another missionary order.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the fact that there were, I do believe that Canada and Nazi Germany had some kind of relationship in terms of these experimentation programs about how to sterilize so-called inferior races.
Well, you know what? I think that the relationship actually is via the crown, basically, because again, eugenics was something that was started up very much in Britain and kind of as a fad, you know, back in the 20s or what have you, and this must have carried over, so to speak, to all the Commonwealth countries, I think.
Well, definitely. I mean, the elites in England and Canada and the U.S., they all had a lot of affinity with Adolf Hitler. They believed, like he did, that so-called inferior groups had to be wiped out, and their methods varied, but the aim was really the same. There's even a very good book called War Against the Weak, America's Plan to Create a Master Race. And it's by Edwin Black. He wrote a good book called IBM and the Holocaust.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And he found that the eugenics movement actually originated in the American medical community in the 1880s. And they were the ones who first brought in these sterilization laws against the so-called feeble-minded, you know, people with lower IQs and that.
Mm.
But it really took off in Canada. The sterilization laws were aimed not just at so-called mentally deficient people, but against so-called morally unfit people, like unwed mothers, you know, teenagers who got pregnant. Native people were considered morally unfit because they weren't Christian. All of these people were slated for sterilizations. And so, I mean, it's something that Hitler picked up on and took further, but it was definitely something that started over here. And the English, of course, really looked favorably on that as well. So, yeah, I think you're right.
How about the idea of, you know, the Bible is a very violent scripture in many regards. We can, you know, I don't like to cherry pick, but if you do, you can find a whole lot about mention about genocide in the Bible and how different peoples are eradicated here, you know, to the left and to the right, and that the Lord commands this and that. How can a moral institution like the church do something like this, you wonder? But then you think back, you know, okay, is this actually something that on one level is encouraged in some way within the theology of Christianity? What do you think, Kevin?
Well, you know, having been in the church, I know that you know, you're taught to see the church in a certain way, and you're deliberately not told about a lot of the actual history. I think Christianity is both. I mean, it has within it, sure, the teachings of Jesus, but in practice, it operates like an institution of empire. That's what Christendom is, really. The church today is not the descendant of Christ. It's really the descendant of the Roman Empire. And when the Christian church was formed, it was with the idea that, like when Constantine gave it legitimacy in the 4th century, he said basically that the church should take over the role of empire and operate the way an empire does, through violence and coercion. Mm. Now, none of that has anything to do with how I've always read, you know, the teachings of Jesus. But Jesus, in fact, became the enemy of the church because a lot of the things he advocated, the church couldn't do if they were going to function like an arm of empire. And in fact, you know, if you look at just the straight facts, Christianity in the world is operated as a very destructive, murderous force.
Yep.
And that's why at the beginning of our film, we have that quote from Deuteronomy, where it says, go and destroy everybody who you meet, who you conquer, because this land has been given to you by God. You're his chosen people. So you have the right to wipe out these people. Don't sign treaties with them. That's not accidental that, you know, people taking that Bible would do that when they come to the New World. They were given religious legitimacy and sanction to do that. And the Vatican and the Church still does that all over the world. So, I mean, you know, it doesn't change. That's the reality.
Mm. Very disturbing indeed. And, you know, if we begin to talk a little bit about the, you know, your story here, so to speak, you've been obviously, you know, they've tried to discredit you. And when we say they, we're talking basically, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Kevin, but we're talking about the heads, you know, from the head office within the United Church. They've been trying to discredit you. They have, you know, delisted you, as they call it, as a kind of, I reckon that would be like the kind of excommunication, similar to that,
yeah,
like the Catholic Church.
Yeah.
Tell us about it.
Well, you know, it was on so many levels, and it still continues today, but, and it happened in stages. Like at first when I wouldn't play along with them, I was fired. I mean, when I was told just before I was fired that if I was to keep my job, I would have to close our food bank and stop preaching about these issues, like about social justice and about these land deals that I was discovering.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't really do that. I mean, for one thing, how could I close a food bank when it was the middle of winter and there were 300 native families that depended on it? So I was kind of given the choice. I had to choose between myself and them. And I couldn't morally do that to people. So, you know, in the short term, that's what caused my firing. But the more I continued to speak out about this, the greater the repression began. The church went, about a month after I was fired, church officials went to my wife and said, look, this man's never going to work again. If you want to divorce him, we'll help pay for the divorce. And, you know, we'll give you documents you can use in divorce court to get custody of your kids. And that's exactly what happened. She's even admitted that in a letter subsequently to the newspaper that her lawyer had met with the church officials to get those documents. So, you know, when I tell people that, they think, I mean, why would a church do that? Go to that extent, like helping a man's divorce, like help his ex-wife get his kids from him. Unless they were really trying to destroy this man, and then why? Like, if he just offended his congregation, why would they go to that extent? And that's the first question that kind of got me realizing, well, there's something more here than what appears to be, right? Because you don't go to that extent if you're just upset about a minister for, you know, upsetting his congregation. There's more
right
at work.
Right.
So the more I encountered that, it's kind of like it would either crush me or I could learn from it and grow from it. And that's what happened. I got stronger because of that. And a good thing that happened was the more the native people witnessed that, the more they began to trust me because I wasn't part of the church anymore. So that's why, you know, within a year of me getting fired, I began to get invited down to the first healing circles that were forming in Vancouver. These are groups that the residential school survivors had formed to just, you know, talk about their pain and try to deal with life. And it was funny how everything coincided, because in that first year, that's when the first lawsuits began. I was part of the first group that sued the United Church. After I was fired, Native people came to me and asked for my help, and the first lawsuit in 1996 was launched against the United Church by people I knew. And it was kind of funny, the same week that they announced their lawsuit against the federal government and the United Church over what had happened to them in the residential school in Port Alberni, that same week the church announced that I was going to be defrocked.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of like their response to this was, okay, well, let's get rid of this guy. He's causing too much trouble for us. And I was the only minister ever in United Church history to be publicly defrocked. It wasn't a behind-the-doors thing. They opened it up to the public. It was like a public show trial to make me look really bad so I would lose credibility with people. Right?
They wanted to make an example out of you, I guess.
Exactly. And it didn't work. It backfired on them because they gave me even more exposure. But still to this day, the United Church claims, oh, there's no proof of what he's saying, even though they've acknowledged the high death rate. I mean, on the one hand, they say these things happen, and if anything, it validates what I've been saying for 10 years, and yet they then turn around and make it look like I'm crazy or something. So they're increasingly looking absurd, you know, the more they try to do that.
And as you said, they've spent, what was it, $250,000 in order to, you know, pay for this whole circus?
That's what we found out, yeah, that the defrocking trial had lasted about 6 months, and it cost them over $250,000, probably closer to $300,000.
Hmm.
You know, and yet they had told me that when I was operating my food bank, it was too expensive. They couldn't afford $1,000 a month to feed hungry Native people in Port Alberni. So,
yeah, right.
You know, it shows you where their priorities are.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you mentioned also in the film there that United Church has been trying, consequence to all of this, that they've been trying to put a gag order on you, that you couldn't talk about your delisting or the killings publicly. Has that gone through, or are you breaking that? What's going on there?
Well, it's funny because they tried that several times. Right after I got delisted, they called it, I got a letter the next day from their lawyer saying if I talk about anything that went on there, I'll be sued. So I thought, well, you know, in a lawsuit, the first thing you do is you sit down during what's called examination for discovery, and your lawyer can ask for any documents from the other side that we need. And I thought, well, that'd be a great opportunity. I could ask for letters out of their archives. So I almost said, go ahead and sue me. Let's get into this.
Right.
But they never did. You know, they on a number of occasions, they even got a Supreme Court order against me because within a few years, I had started my own radio program. I still have a community radio program in Vancouver where we talk about a lot of these issues every week.
Mm-hmm.
And they got a Supreme Court order to silence me, saying if I talked about any of this over the air, I'd be in violation of an injunction and I could go to jail. I ignored it. That was in 2002. 6 years later, I'm still talking about it. They've never enforced that Supreme Court writ. They've never brought me to trial.
Is that something that they could bring up, do you think, and say, look here, you've been talking about this now for 6 years, now you're going to go to jail or whatever?
But they couldn't do that because any judge would look at that and say, well, look, if you have proof that Kevin Annett is lying or libeling you, why didn't you ever enforce this injunction? Why didn't you ever take him to court?
Mm.
And they have, you know, in 12 years of me bringing all of this evidence out, not once has any of the churches or the government come forward with counter evidence. They've never refuted it. They've never said it's not true. And under the law, when you do that, you're consenting to what's being said. You're not challenging it. So in effect, they've already acknowledged through their silence that this is all true.
Hmm.
The question is, you know, they're still in charge, so how are they going to be brought to trial? How are they going to be held accountable? That's the big question.
Yeah. And, you know, what is your kind of situation right now then? I mean, Are you in any contact at all with your family anymore? You are?
My daughters are 19 and 16. They've grown up, and in fact, they're both really supportive. It's kind of funny. I never made a point of fighting with their mom a lot. I just told them, look, you know, love both of us and just respect us and learn at your own time what happened. I didn't try to force them to take sides or anything. And that's really helped because now, you know, we have really a great relationship because they can see now why I did everything I had to do. And, you know, my ex-wife still has a very kind of unreasonable anger towards me, and not surprisingly, because she has a lot of that history that, you know, having colluded with the church to help try to destroy me, really. It's a lawyer told me the other day that what she did and what they did is under the law called criminal conspiracy.
Yep, yep.
And that can put people away for 10 or 20 years. When you conspire to destroy somebody to hide your own crimes, that's a serious crime. And, I mean, they're all liable for that. So, I mean, no wonder people continue to try to, you know, smear me, because they have a lot to lose if this ever came out in a big way. Like, if I had $1 million and can sue all of them, definitely a lot of this would come out. And that's probably what's going to have to happen one day.
Well, that sounds like a good idea. I mean, don't you think it's time to clean up some of this mess? I mean, it's been lingering on for quite a while, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't, I'm kind of in a funny position, because often I'll wake up and think, I mean, it seems like me against the entire system here. And in one sense it is, but there's so many people out there who are coming forward now. A lot of Native people just on the ground who come forward to confirm, to tell more stories. I'll give you an example to show you how the tide is changing. In Canada, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation had a TV last July. They had what they call a town hall meeting in Regina, where Native people could come in front of the camera and tell stories about what they saw in the residential schools. A woman called Irene Favel got up. She's 75. And she said when she was a little girl, there was another girl on her dorm who got pregnant from a priest. The priest had raped her. She was only 11. And when the baby was born, she saw that priest take the baby and throw it into a furnace in the basement. She was an eyewitness. And others came forward to describe how they used to hold the furnace door open when, you know, the fetuses and other kids who had died were burned up in the residential school furnace. She told that story, and the white woman who was interviewing her didn't bat an eye. She didn't have an emotional reaction at all. And nobody who was on the show even referred to it. So it's kind of like, how can you hear that story? How can you know all these children died and not respond? And yet the truth is coming out more and more. So it's kind of like, it's this huge denial, Holocaust denial really happening. And at some point, something's got to break. And one of the ways to do that, of course, is just getting the truth out more. And that's happening. So, you know, I'm confident that it will, you can see it crumbling before your eyes in a way.
That's very good. I mean, it's definitely time for that. And you know, do you want to kind of, you know, name any names or the people that are after you kind of right now, or even in regards to companies? You mentioned like one of the big, you know, mining companies before that, but are there anything more like that? You know, the people that are, you know, that are after you and have been really hard hitting in, you know, trying to keep you away from uncovering this story?
Well, it's all sorts of officials within the United Church, you know, that are responsible. Sergeant Peter Montague of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police in Vancouver, he's kind of led the smear campaign. He hires Native people to go in and disrupt my meetings and say, oh, Native people don't support Kevin Annett. There was an insider in the RCMP who phoned me up one day and told me a lot of this stuff and showed me, eventually mailed me some things which showed that, you know, there were informants, paid Native informants that were going around to disrupt my work. You know, there's been out of the Public Relations Department in Toronto of the United Church, they've been leading this whole smear for a number of years, you know, farming out articles to the media that make it look like I'm crazy, having Native people come forward and say that, you know, they don't support what I'm doing, just kind of on that level. On a bigger level, there was, it's interesting, some of the companies that are threatened by some of this work, including Camco, it's actually the biggest uranium company in the world. They do a lot of their mining in northern Saskatchewan, and right after I released a list, last April I released a list of mass graves that are close to former residential schools, 28 grave sites across the country of where these children are buried, from eyewitnesses and other information. Some of these sites are right on the land that Camco wanted to mine, and so right after that they sponsored a reporter to come and write a very bad article about me. Really was a character assassination, and they got that all over the media, but it was a reporter working for Camco, and, you know, so, I mean, and, you know, there's bigger forces at work, as I learned, you know, the letter that got me fired was because I found out about this land deal going on, so I think it does come down to the question of the land and the resources and the big moneyed interests that are threatened by all of this stuff coming out.
And are the church, like, you know, gaining anything from this in regards to that they are actually given money, or is it just that there's so much kind of weaved in and a part of the system, that this is kind of this comes with the territory in nowadays, if you, you know, are involved in a church or whatever?
Well, both. Definitely there have been direct payoffs to the church after they've given over their land to different companies. That kind of payoff I've documented in the film and in my book, Hidden from History, The Canadian Holocaust. But the other thing to remember in this is that, you know, in Canada, there's kind of this three-headed hydra, the church, corporate sector, and the government. They've always worked together hand in hand. A lot of the early missionaries were also the local Indian agent, and they often helped set up the local timber company and that on the West Coast here. You know, that relationship is very old. It goes way back. And so the point is that they're like criminals that have done this terrible thing. They all have a vested interest in helping one another keep it quiet. And, you know, that's definitely the case. Now, the churches, to give you an example of this, this, you know, measly $10,000 compensation that survivors might get, that has not come from the churches. The Canadian taxpayers are putting that money forward.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the government and taxpayers that are paying off, you know, that are saving the church from having to pay a dime for any of this. So, I mean, it's just open collusion. And I think the reason the churches are being protected so much is because if they ever went on the witness stand, a lot of this stuff would come out because they were the main perpetrators. So the government is really having to protect them to, you know, protect themselves and to stop this fuller story from coming out.
Mm. Now, Kevin, before we continue here and talk a little bit more in our members section, I do want to talk just briefly about your website, of course, and also some of the material you have out there. I want to ask you if you have your film, if that's available on DVD. If so, does that help to support your cause here, so to speak, in regards to if people purchase a DVD, for instance?
Yes, very much it does. People can see the film on Google Video or on our website. You can watch it online. But it does help if people want to purchase a DVD. It's $20 Canadian. You can find out how to order it right on our website, www.hiddenfromhistory.org. And I'm hoping to come to Europe in the spring, and it would be great if people would like me to come and speak in their communities so I can talk about a lot of this. There have been some good developments recently. Some of the native chiefs have been talking about, they've actually issued eviction notices to these churches. They said, well, if you're not going to disclose where these children are buried, you have to get off our land now. So we've been holding demonstrations in Vancouver where we actually post these eviction notices. We've gone into churches and said, you know, these buildings are now under the control of the Squamish traditional chiefs. And the next step they're going to take is some of the traditional chiefs want to set up their own courts of law, because the white courts aren't going to try these people. They're going to issue arrest warrants and bring in known perpetrators and try them in Aboriginal courts of law.
Mm-hmm.
So that's very exciting, because that's a real declaration of sovereignty when they begin doing that. And I think that's one of the ways that these crimes are going to come out, and that people are going to be held accountable. It's going to be by native people doing it themselves, not waiting for the government. And so anyway, all of that is happening now, and you can learn about that on our website. And in getting the film out is a really, and having me come and speak is a really important way to help us.
Very good. The website again is hiddenfromhistory.org. And also, I just want to mention here before we take a short break here, the book is also called Hidden from History. Is this still in print, Kevin? Is this out?
Yes, I was never able to get a publisher to publish it. You see, we've got a lot of the evidence in this book. It's about 500 pages long. It's like a resource book. It's got a lot of the documents proving genocide, the high death rate, the records showing the 50% death rate, a lot of testimonies to support the documents. All that's in our book. And I, because nobody would publish it, I've just had to print it myself. And it costs $50, and you can, again, order it from my address, which is on our website.
Very good. The website, again, hiddenfromhistory.org. We're going to continue talking more with Kevin Annett in our member section about the mentality and psychology of the people involved in the genocide, and ask the deeper question of why this is really happening. We'll talk more about the power structure and the connection to other pedophile networks around the world, and ask if there's a connection even to the satanic networks that we've heard about. We'll also talk about the robotification of the human race and how this connects with the eradication of the native peoples around the world, and because they're more connected with the earth. We'll talk about the United New World Order, and that is going to be kind of a monoculture where everyone is going to be the same, with no diversity. So, to listen, if you're not a member, head on over to redicecreations.com, click on subscribe and take advantage of our member section. It's filled with video interviews, our live programs in their entirety, short films, and of course our entire radio archive. I also want to give you a heads up, this coming Saturday, the 18th at 6 p.m. Universal Time, we have Michael Tesarian with us on Red Ice Live. Video and audio feeds live from our studio. We're going to talk about the chronology of tyranny, the different empires popping up around the world, and the timeline of that, and much more. You can find all the information and the player and so forth if you go to our website, redicecreations.com, click on the Red Ice Live banner, and we have more times from the different time zones up there for you, so you know when you should tune in. Okay, so more with Kevin Annette coming up now in our member section. Forces are the same that burn crosses. Some of those that work forces are the same that burn crosses. Some of those that work forces are the same that burn crosses. Some of those that work forces draw the same that burn crosses. Now you do what they told ya. Now you do what they told ya. Now you do what they told ya. And 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 now you do what they told ya. Now you do what they told you. Now you do what they told you. Now you do what they told you.